Learn more at lifewellplan.com. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate.
From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made in the air with small, unmanned aircraft you might call drone. Some are offended by that term. Others say it's the easy term to use. Well, we're talking drones this hour, and two incidents just recently help explain why drones are viewed both with excitement and, for some, concern. The BBC flew a drone equipped with a camera to take an aerial view of Auschwitz. 70 years after the liberation of the concentration camp, the BBC wanted the chance to show viewers what it looked like from the air, and the results, haunting, powerful images. It was a case of a drone being used to help the public gain information. Then there was yesterday. A radio-controlled civilian drone landed on the White House lawn, sparking new debate over what is safe and what is not. There are questions about privacy, about who should be allowed to use drones, how high in the air, how close to our homes. We welcome your comments and questions this hour. And if you want to call the program and join the conversation, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. My guest in studio is Brian Petrie. He teaches a new course at MCC designed to train pilots of small, unmanned aerial vehicles, and his company is called SkyOp. Nice to see you, Brian.
Well, thank you, Evan. I'm glad to be here.
And nice to have you. Agamemnon Krasidis is on the phone. He's an RIT associate professor and one of the foremost local experts in the field on this. Agamemnon, thanks for taking the time as well.
Thank you, Evan.
I'm going to start with this, Agamemnon. You saw the White House incident. Are we overreacting to a drone on the White House lawn, or should that be a concern?
I think it's part of both. I think it is an overreaction. The person came up and admitted that it was not intentional. And as these become more popular within our airspace, you'll see more of those types of incidents. But I think it's much more of an overreaction than a concern at this point.
Agamemnon, define when you hear drone, or what term do you prefer? Let's get some definitions here. Drone.
Drone has more of a military connotation where we like to refer to them as unmanned aircraft systems or aerial systems, typically called UASs. The work that we're trying to look at is more on the commercial side, and this is what I'm associated with related to the new FAA test site that's located out in Rome, New York. It's really looking at commercial applications for unmanned aircraft systems, and you know, we feel that that could actually be the economic driver for the U.S. in the future, much like the automobile was an economic driver at the turn of the century and also the advent of powered aircraft flight. So we're just looking more at commercial applications, and there are lots of commercial applications for these unmanned aircraft systems that have not even come to fruition yet, particularly related to the agricultural industry, where we can use these systems to monitor crops and increase the crop yield and monitor fertilizer runoff and make it safer for the environment. We could also use these systems for monitoring forest fires and hot zones to squelch these forest fires before they actually occur. So those types of applications mostly related to the commercial side, and one of the things that needs to be looked at is how to integrate them into the national airspace system safely and effectively and cost-effectively, and that's what this whole test site was set up for.
Brian, when you hear the term drone, and again, the host is using it right now because the audience is familiar with it, but again, you prefer which term to drone?
Small unmanned aerial systems.
Does drone turn your stomach a little, or is it a pejorative, do you think?
I think it's the sort of thing that the public just attaches to anything that now flies in this particular fashion. It's really interesting that just last weekend I was teaching at Mohawk Valley Community College and a class on Saturday, and the day before they called me and they said, Brian, we just wanted to give you a heads up. There's a person coming to demonstrate against these drones in your class. And I was like, oh, well, thanks for the heads up, but I really think that this person just doesn't understand what this is all about. And I think there's a lot of confusion with the word drone. And much like other things in our society, whether it's a Xerox copy or a Kleenex, I mean, sometimes it's the popular references that become, you know, the thing that sticks.
So, Brian, you are teaching a class now at MCC. In fact, you created this class for MCC. What is SkyOp? And then we'll talk a little bit about the class. What is SkyOp?
SkyOp is an education company. We sat down this past year, and I created this curriculum because none existed. And we're still waiting for the FAA to come out with what they believe should be done for commercial certification. I went and I researched what was being done in Canada and in the United Kingdom, and I took parts of that. And all the things that I had learned over the past 3 years about what the average person would want to know about these, whether they want to fly them as a hobby or to create a business or have a job.
Okay, and so the class in MCC is essentially for the general public. You got to pay a fee and you can take the class, and you come out with what?
Well, you come out with an awful lot of knowledge. What we find is people typically come in and they have some sort of preconceived notion about how they think they'd like to use these particular systems. And in almost every case, people come up to me after the class and they say, wow, we have a far broader understanding of what the capabilities of these particular systems are. And maybe they're thinking about them in one way, for example, just aerial photography. But then they come out and they find out that it can be used in construction and insurance and agriculture and all these different disciplines.
Let me get a few of our listener comments in early here. Again, we're talking about small unmanned aerial vehicles, or drones to some people, but small unmanned aerial vehicles, many of them the size that simply you could pick up and hold in your hand. And a quick question before we get to the phones comes from a listener named Jake. He says, I think the privacy concerns about drones are mostly overblown. Existing privacy and property laws pretty much cover all drone uses. I do think registration of pilots and serial numbers on hardware should be required, as well as insurance. Agamemnon, is Jake right? Do we have good enough answers for existing privacy and property laws regarding drones? For example, we had a number of listeners this morning say, well, if a drone, how much do I own in the airspace above my house? And can a drone come into the airspace above my house, near a bedroom window, et cetera?
No, we do have extensive privacy laws on the books already. And what's going to happen is the FAA is going to home in on those further as these systems become more and more popular. So that's one of the things that the FAA is definitely looking at. And we can assure everybody that that's one of the biggest factors in terms of integrating these into the national airspace system, is those types of concerns. And, in terms of public perception as well, I think that's one of the hurdles of integrating these into the national airspace system, is the public perception related to those privacy concerns. But the FAA will be extensive in terms of outlining exactly what can be done in terms of privacy. And with what they've started off with already, I think just picking up on that and then integrating them within the national airspace system will, again, bring those laws into fruition and alleviate everybody's concerns.
And Brian Petrie, are you concerned that getting some further answers in terms of these laws and rules and guidelines is going to be delayed because of this White House incident? Is this the kind of thing where your community is saying, here we go again, people will overreact, and that could derail this process of getting online?
Actually, I'm hoping the opposite will occur. I think it's really interesting that the FAA is way behind, almost 3 years, in fact, in coming out with their proposed rules. And I'm hopeful that in some ways people are going to look at this and say, wow, we really have to do something about it. We're currently behind the rest of the world in allowing these things to fly in this country, and it's putting us in a bad position. You know, this technology started here in our country, and today we find that Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, Germany, they're all further advanced than we are with this particular technology.
Let me grab a phone call. This is Tony in Geneseo. Tony, you're on Connections.
Hi. I have a question and a comment.
Okay.
So my question is, I'd like your guest to specifically state an existing law that protects the privacies of individuals. Like, I mean, one of your commenters or just said that there was a sufficient laws, but I'd like to find out if they really know if the laws are out there or not. And I have another name for these. And the other name I would call these things are kinetic energy weapons. And I don't think that this is an overreaction in any kind of case, right, at all. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Tony. I'll start with Brian, then go to Agamemnon. Kinetic energy weapons.
Wow, that's one I hadn't heard before, and I feel that there is another name that I would call them, and they are data collection machines. The data that they can collect goes beyond just photographs and videos, but all forms of sensors, and the true value of these things, once you begin to understand it, is how they're applied to other systems overall and what that can do in vertical marketplaces.
Agamemnon, he says they are kinetic energy weapons. I'll start there. What do you think?
Well, so is an automobile. So is regular aircraft. So are many other types of systems. And again, it's the education that we have to do a better job in terms of understanding what these systems do and what they're capable of doing. But I'm sure the same questions were being raised when the automobile was coming to fruition in the turn of the century.
What about the question of specific laws? He seems skeptical that current law, that specific laws would protect privacy in regards to drones.
There are current laws on the books. Again, they're not where they should be, but there are also laws that allow only under certain conditions for these kind of systems to operate. For example, if it's considered a model aircraft, it cannot operate more than 400 feet within 5 miles of an aircraft. So those types of laws already exist out there. But again, the FAA needs to do a little bit more work in terms of really homing in these types of privacy laws, as Brian mentioned.
Okay. I want to make sure I'm clear on that, Agamemnon, because I had read over the last 18 months or so, 400 feet, is that still in play as a limit in terms of aerial?
That's correct.
Okay, 400 feet. And one of my own colleagues said, hey, can we just get a quick explanation on what the difference is between a model airplane and a drone? And Brian, you said to that?
Well, there's not a great deal of difference. And in fact, it's one of the things that has been recently litigated based upon the FAA regulations. Model airplanes have been flown in this country successfully and safely, I might add, for 75 years. And some of the litigation was pointing to that particular item. That, unfortunately, was just overturned in a recent case. And so there's some real debate as to, are they different or are they the same? But it's coming down to they're basically the same when you look at them.
So Agamemnon, again, you heard from our listener who has concern, but part of the message from Agamemnon and Brian is that there is an opportunity, an economic driver here. And Agamemnon, you started talking about some of those, but give me a sense for 5-10 years from now, what is the possible application that we are not currently employing drones for?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest applications I mentioned before is agricultural use, forest fighting type uses, search and rescue type uses. Brian mentioned the insurance agencies for assessing damage on buildings instead of having an assessor go on a roof that is damaged and could possibly get hurt. We can have these unmanned aircraft systems assess the damage for that assessor. So those types of applications. There's also another interesting application related to detecting gas leaks in pipelines. So imagine unmanned aircraft systems being able to do these instead of having gas companies have thousands of their assessors go out and see if they can assess if there's a gas leak or anything. We can do this over the air. So those types of applications, again, mostly related to commercial applications.
Brian, what other applications do you see?
Well, when I first looked into this particular technology, I sat down and I wrote down a list of vertical applications that I thought they could address. I came up initially in my list with 86 vertical markets, and I was wrong. It turns out I believe there's hundreds or thousands of applications. I think the most interesting ones are the ones we haven't even thought of yet. There's a video that came out about 60 days ago that's on the internet, and it's called an ambulance drone. And some really sharp people over in the Netherlands have put together the idea of a quadcopter that is used if a person was to have a heart attack and they needed a defibrillator, that they feel they can fly a defibrillator very rapidly. In fact, it's at 100 kilometers an hour to a location and actually save patients. And it's just a real eye-opener when you see that as things that I never thought of that these things are going to be used for.
What are your biggest concerns? What are there negatives in play, Brian?
There's always negatives with these things. It's really not the technology. It's the person that's behind them. You know, I feel that the biggest problem today is people really don't understand how to use these. And that's why we came up with the curriculum that we did. People can walk into a hobby shop today. They can buy one of these systems. And I've talked to many people, unfortunately, who say, oh, yeah, I got this particular flight system, like a DJI Phantom. And the first thing I did was I went outside and I wanted to see how high it would go. Well, they don't understand that there's a 400-foot restriction in doing so. So it's really the lack of the education and the understanding of how these things should be done correctly.
When it comes to the cost here, Agamemnon, right now, if you want to pick up a system that Brian's talking about, walk into a store, can you do it for, well, you can do it for how much or less?
I think anywhere between $200 and $500.
Okay. And Will writes to us and says, it's still unclear to me if you need a special license to do this.
There isn't currently a licensing requirement out there. What the FAA did state, and what they referred to as the roadmap that came out a little more than a year ago, was that they were going to require certification for commercial applications. And frankly, that's something that I personally endorse very much. I really think that people do need to have training with regard to how these are used safely in the airspace.
Agamemnon, what do you think in terms of training?
Yeah, I think it all goes back down to educating the public, and also public perception in terms of educating that, you know, these systems have a very viable commercial market that could be an economic engine for this country. And again, it all relates down to education, particularly for public perception.
Talking to Agamemnon Krasidis, an RIT associate professor, Brian Petrie, who teaches a new course at MCC designed to train pilots of small unmanned aerial vehicles. And Brendan writes to us about, I think following up on Agamemnon's point about many of the applications that could be in play here. He says, my concern is it sounds like they could eventually cost jobs currently performed by people. Agamemnon?
That was true for computers, but how many jobs did computer industry create? So for every job that could be possibly lost, you know, other jobs can be gained.
What do you think, Brian?
I agree totally with Ag. It is a disruptive technology, and disruptive technologies are normally the biggest things that have an economic impact, and this is certainly one of them. It's a question that I'm asked frequently in class, and I agree. It's going to create a whole host of jobs that we haven't even envisioned yet.
When it comes to Jeff Bezos, Amazon, you know, he caused quite a ruckus when he said on 60 Minutes that he could foresee small unmanned aerial vehicles or drones delivering packages to customers. Agamemnon, what was your response when that kind of came out?
I think we're years away from that. Again, there's privacy concerns related to that aspect of using unmanned aircraft systems. You know, for me, you better make sure that package arrives where you intended to arrive and not somebody else's house. Again, I think that type of technology is probably years away. I think you'll see other applications occurring before that occurs.
Brian?
Everything that Ag said is true, but I think the real value that Jeff Bezos did when he brought that out in 60 Minutes, I can tell you that the discussion changed for many people in this country.
In what way?
Because people so often think of the word drone and they think of it as a killing machine. And all of a sudden, I began to have my telephone ring more frequently and people calling up and saying, oh, I can see now because of what Jeff Bezos is talking about that these can be used in a whole host of different ways. And it really has helped, I think, the public perception that these are very positive vehicles. It's a really transformative technology that's going to change a lot of things.
We got a few more minutes with Agamemnon Krasidis, a RIT associate professor, and one of our listeners, Mark, says, the issue with the White House incident is radar contact. Too many of these vehicles are too small to detect on radar, and if you can't be on radar, you probably should be illegal. Is that too strong a comment for you, Agamemnon?
I would think so. There's other ways to mitigate that. You know, we do this with aircraft as well. We have transponders on those types of systems to keep track of aircraft. So I would think that's probably too much of an overreaction to state that at this point.
Brian, what do you think?
Totally an overreaction. I think that it is true that they cannot be detected by radar, but there's all forms of things that are going on. And in fact, here with New Air and what's going on at Griffiths, they're really focused on the idea of collision avoidance. And I think that is just a beginning into some of the answers to the question that you posed.
Well, collision avoidance is an important topic, and I want to get that in just a second. I want to make sure we read President Obama's comments that are I think, just a few hours old here, following up on this question about drone rules and the incident of a remote-controlled quadcopter. It was a quadcopter, my understanding, Brian?
That's correct. It was a DJI Phantom.
Okay. That crash-landed on the White House lawn. The president says, quote, let's see here. You need to get the good and minimize the bad from drones. These are incredibly useful functions that these drones can play in terms of farmers who are managing crops and conservationists who want to take stock of wildlife, the president said. But we don't really have any kind of regulatory structure at all for it. end quote. So part of Brian's point is, well, what have we been waiting for? You know, the regulatory structure. You do view us as being way behind, Brian.
We are way behind, and there was an interesting discourse that went on in Congress back in December, and I watched it with great interest because what we saw is finally Congress beginning to understand that the FAA has been dragging their feet for some time. And one of the questions that they asked was of the FAA, who, in my personal opinion, think they're sort of leading the charge in terms of regulations. They said, why aren't you looking at what's going on in other countries like Canada and Australia and the UK, and how can you learn from that? And what have you done to adopt the things that they've already addressed in their countries and tried to apply them here? And every answer that came back from the FAA was sort of empty in terms of, well, we're looking at that, or well, we're assessing that. And it's really sort of taking a broader look at what's going on elsewhere and applying it here. And they could move much quicker if they would do that.
Who's doing it? Who's regulating them the best, Brian? Who's got the most extensive idea for how drones should be behaving and governed?
I find some of the things that are going on in Canada are doing quite well. They adopted very early on. They take an approach that's different than the FAA. In my personal opinion, the FAA is trying to make sure, I get it that they're there trying to make everything safe, and that's certainly a big job. But what you see happening in other countries is more of a risk-based approach. You know, we see daily in the newspaper almost today where, oh, they saw some drone that was up next to an airliner at an airport. And what's really happened is nothing so far. When you look at what's gone on in these other countries, they haven't had collisions, okay? But they're looking at the risks and trying to mitigate those risks by actually learning and doing rather than theorizing. And I think that the FAA is just a little too meticulous in their approach versus other countries.
Agamemnon, before we let you go, what are you working on? What's your latest bit of either research or work in different sectors on this that you look forward to that, you know, that you feel is within reach with kind of proper steps from whether it's the FAA or whoever's involved in sort of making sure that this is accessible for the business community, the research community, the agriculture community, et cetera?
Yeah, that relates to the unmanned aircraft system FAA test site that was awarded back December 30th of 2013 to New York and Massachusetts. Obviously, we're doing a lot of integrated research for collision avoidance. I think that is one area that needs to be brought up for these to be integrated into the national airspace system, not only avoiding large buildings, but avoiding smaller objects like tree limbs and power lines. So that type of research is going on here at RIT. And we're also looking at sensors and trying to make sensors just as accurate and less expensive than the $80,000 units, where you probably were not going to put an $80,000 unit in an unmanned aircraft system that costs $500. So I think those two areas are the most likely areas that we're going to be looking at.
How close are we with just the functionality of collision avoidance?
You do a lot of that already. Again, for the larger scale stuff. But again, for the smaller scale stuff, I think there still needs to be some work on as applications I mentioned, the tree limb kind of applications and the power line applications.
Brian, when you work with people, whether through SkyOp or MCC, the question of collision avoidance, what do you tell them?
I tell them that there is research that's being done. We still have a long ways to go. I mean, we see where there's little pockets of things occurring, whether they're in things like LIDAR or sonar or computerized vision technologies that could be possible ways of solving this particular problem. And there are little instances of those or pockets, like I said, going on all over the country.
Agamemnon, before we let you go, last question then. What do you think is realistic for the president? What do you want to see from this administration before his term is up to kind of go forward with this?
I think we need to act quickly. As Brian mentioned, we're behind the eight ball in terms of other countries. At least get to the place where other countries are within the next 2 years, particularly, as Brian mentioned, Canada and in Japan as well. So I think that's what I would foresee within the next 2 years.
Agamemnon Christidis at RIT, thanks for taking the time to join our conversation today.
Thank you very much.
All right, we're going to take a 60-second break. More of your questions answered. We're going to come back with Brian Petrie. We're going to hear from the Innovation Trail's Ryan Delaney. And again, try to answer as much as we can about this future of these aircraft. And if you're wondering why Brian kind of gets irked by the notion of the term drone, if you Google drone, one of the first things you find is a picture of a Reaper drone firing a missile. And Brian, I know that's exactly your point, that for first impression for many people when they hear it, That really still is it, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. Well, he's trying to make us think of the term small unmanned
aerial systems.
Aerial systems. Small unmanned aerial systems. You need a better acronym. What's the acronym?
SUAS.
Yeah, we need a SWAS, SUAS. Yeah, we need a better term for that. Brian Petrie's in studio with me, and your questions answered right after this 60-second break on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the next Connections, our first hour, we're talking about whistleblowers. And second hour, we're talking Pope Francis. He's made many comments that, at least on the surface, seem to conflict with Catholic doctrine. But what's the reality behind that? What is the Pope all about? What are your thoughts on Pope Francis? Join those conversations Wednesday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Wealth Strategies Group at Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, offering financial planning strategies that are tailored to clients' needs. Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, investing in you.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Brian Petrie is here from Sky Up, and he is teaching a course that he created at MCC, helping people understand how they can operate these unmanned aerial systems. And before I jump over to Ryan Delaney, my colleague from the Innovation Trail, Brian, your short critique, but I think is a fair one for the media, is that to some degree, the question of a public perception, you say it's changing about these systems, but maybe it's slower to change than you'd like because sometimes of the media portrayal?
I think media has gotten an awful lot better in just the past year or so. Originally, when I was getting interviewed or on television or radio in the past, they would spend half the time talking about these drones or small unmanned aerial systems, and the other half of the time was always based upon the privacy issue. What I think has occurred in media, and I think it's a very positive thing, is all of a sudden media has gotten a hold of the idea that this is going to be part of their future. You see, these small unmanned aerial systems are going to change the way we deliver news, whether it's in the newspaper, television, radio. It's going to augment the way that you report stories, and it's going to change it dramatically. And now I see those professionals talking less about the negatives and more about when can we use this? And I think that's what we're going to see.
As we saw, as I opened the hour with the BBC using it, for example, but Brian said, well, no surprise, they're more in the clear for the, again, Brian's been talking about other countries that are more down the road in terms of deciding who can use it and where, right?
Yes, they're more progressive.
Okay, well, let me bring in Ryan Delaney from the Innovation Trail, our colleague. Ryan, how are you?
Doing okay, guys. Good to talk to you.
Well, I know you've reported on drones plenty, and what are the, when you report on this, you heard Brian's take on this, but what are the big questions that come up for you in the course of your reporting for Innovation Trail?
I would say it's still privacy a lot. People are concerned about them. I do think that the overall education level about these has increased as it's been in the news more. There is a little less fear about them and more just concern or question. That is still certainly an area that there's some misconceptions and some misunderstandings or just lack of information right now.
Ryan, our guests have talked about application, especially on the agricultural side. In the course of your reporting, give us a sense for what you've encountered for those who are pushing for this kind of sort of a broadening of an opportunity to use small unmanned aerial system technology.
Well, I think Professor Kasidis also mentioned natural gas. That's a big one that they're using them in Canada right now for, which, you know, the Canadian Aviation Agency that oversees aviation in Canada has been approving UAS uses a lot more than we're seeing here in the States. A lot of them inspecting pipelines, inspecting wind farms, inspecting drill sites, a lot of things that, you know, might take a lot longer to walk alongside or just be a lot more expensive for a helicopter or a, you know, single prop plane to be able to do. Search and rescue, forest fires is one I've heard. On the medical side, I've also heard of being able to move or transplant or transport organ transplants as one, kind of similar to that defibrillator delivery that we heard about in Europe.
Brian, you've heard that?
Yes, I have, and I think it's a great idea.
James writes to the program, let's say I own a small aircraft, it crashes and hurts or worse, kill someone? Do I have insurance? Is there drone insurance? Should there be? And who's liable? Let me start with Brian on that one.
Number one, flat out, you should have insurance. And that doesn't matter if you're an amateur or if you were doing something more commercialized. I can tell you that you can, from the Academy of Model Aeronautics, by taking a one-year membership, you can get liability insurance for something like your $80 a year membership. So I encourage people to do that. It's a great way to get some basic coverage. In my business, I actually buy liability insurance out of Arizona, and I carry a $1 million policy that covers all my flight systems.
Okay. It sounds to me, though, Ryan, that in the course of your reporting, you're hearing fewer concerns about what do I do if this thing malfunctions or crashes, and still more about privacy. As Brian kind of noted, that's been the hang-up for more people as opposed to the functional and the step-by-step if there's a malfunction.
Yeah, you know, I think it's more just a fear of something new. I've had a lot of people point out the fact that, you know, there's license plate readers on police cars, police security cameras in a lot of urban areas. So it's not like we're not being surveilled right now. This is just a different way of doing it that people probably don't know as much about. Not to say that, you know, there aren't concerns about other ways that we're being watched and tracked, like through our phones. I've had people tell me that, you know, in a lot of cases, your neighbor having a drone's not really that different than a neighbor having a tall ladder. And being able to see over a fence, you can't really build a fence high enough to keep one of these out.
Brian, you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, the basic rule of privacy law in the United States that we have today is really if there's an expected piece of privacy that you have as a citizen. Let me give you an example. You mentioned a ladder over a fence. If I'm in a backyard and I have a totally stockade fence, you expect privacy that you're behind that particular fence. Yes, a flight system could fly over the top, but then you're invading that person's privacy. The laws that are there today, whether they be stalking laws or other laws against privacy, are based upon that ruling. Just recently, Jerry Brown over in California enacted an enhancement to that law, which basically said the same thing. If a person has an expectation of privacy, then they should be granted that particular privacy. On the flip side, it's also a case in privacy that you can't take anything public and make it private. The examples there are things like if you look at Google Earth and you can see your house and you have the street view and things of that nature, and those all exist because they're public. So you have to walk that fine line. I can tell you that I've had people who, when they found out that I had the small unmanned aerial system, said, "Oh, you're coming to look in my bedroom window." And the thing that I tell them is, believe me, I didn't spend as much money and as much time to go do that as I am interested in all the positive aspects that this technology brings about.
Brett writes, if the government can get a surveillance tool, the government is likely to abuse it. Brian, what do you think?
That's an interesting one. I think that also we've seen already in multiple states, New Jersey and again back to California, that they have vetoed the idea of getting search warrants to be able to use these particular systems. And I think it goes back to that whole idea of you can't take something public and make it private. Mm-hmm. I think that it really impedes law enforcement, who stands to benefit a lot from these particular systems. And I don't believe that they're out there to try to make privacy an issue.
If you want to join the program, it's 844-295-TALK. If you've got questions or comments on these small unmanned aerial systems or in vehicles, it's 844-295-TALK or 263-WXXI. That's the number. 263-WXXI. That's 9994. Ryan Delaney from the Innovation Trails on the line with us, and Brian Petrie just mentioned that other states, state by state, we may see a bit of a variance in terms of how they're dealt with. Ryan, we've been talking for much of this hour about what the FAA and what the Obama administration wants to do. Are we seeing much movement on a state level or much interest and an appetite for dealing with this on a state level here?
I think so. You know, I don't know if you mean particularly regulations about them. We are seeing a lot of those across states city councils or county legislatures passing restrictions or, you know, limiting use of drones when it comes to their local police departments. Some, like here in Syracuse, the city council kind of took more of a wait-and-see law, saying that they're not going to allow police use of unmanned aerial systems until the FAA comes out with better guidelines. In terms of the economic side and the testing aspect of it, I would say that, you know, here in New York, the state is supportive of it. They've given New Air, that testing alliance, a few million dollars to help cover the startup costs. So if it's not necessarily something that you're seeing or hearing the governor talk about, it is something that you know, the legislature is willing to put money behind.
All right, let me grab a couple of phone calls. Ryan Delaney, can you hang with us for a little while longer?
Absolutely.
Ryan Delaney is an Innovation Trail reporter, one of the stable of great reporters we have at Innovation Trail. And let me get Anthony in Brighton. Anthony, go ahead.
Hi. How you doing, guys?
Good.
Thanks for the show. I build very large octocopters, 40 pounds. And I'm also a licensed pilot. My biggest concern, and by the way, the AMA insurance only covers non-commercial liability, not commercial liability. They're thinking of coming up with a commercial policy soon, but it's not here yet. My biggest concern is there's a cavalier approach to these things where the public's not aware they're actually dangerous. Even a small quadcopter, you can lose an eye with. So I think the main concern should be focused on safety, training people to get these things off the shelf, you know, how to use them properly, how not to fly over crowds, how to be safe. As a licensed pilot, that's my main concern, and I think that has to be really driven home, because there's a lot of people out there that really don't know what they're doing, and they're flying these things around, and they can be quite dangerous.
Anthony, you mentioned you build. What was the term that you – I saw Brian Petrie was nodding, but I missed the term. What was the kind of vehicle you build?
Oh, octocopter. It just means that it has 8 engines. It could be a hexcopter with 6, a quadcopter with 4. Et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, let me start with Brian Petrie. Thoughts on what he said there?
Well, we've gone a great distance in our class, for example, of making safety and best practices a big part of what we teach. So we're totally in agreement with Anthony in that particular regard. Safety is what it's all about. Unfortunately, today we're looking towards people who are saying, well, why don't you put a little safety card inside these boxes when people, you know, buy a system? I think that's just a silly act, if you will. And that's why I really think that for commercial applications, certification is required. You really have to understand safety. Anthony brought up a great one, which is never fly over crowds. I mean, and that is an absolute that we teach in our classes. So it is. It's all about safety and doing these things the right way.
And Anthony, we've talked this hour about collision avoidance. And interestingly enough, Agamemnon Krasidis at RIT saying that, you know, we're getting there in terms of the kind of systems. But if you're going to purchase a $500 vehicle, but the safety system is, say, $1,000 or $5,000 or $10,000, you might not be interested. Where do you come down when it comes to just how safe they can be currently?
Well, that's a great question, and I think I have a simple answer to that. The safety right now is in the pilot's hands. That's the number one safety component of the aircraft. And until systems become more developed and less expensive so that the average folk can buy it, we really have to just educate the pilots that that's their main responsibility. Even when I'm flying a full-size aircraft, I'm more concerned with other people's safety than my own. So that means people in my aircraft and people on the ground. So I think it's in the pilot's hands.
Anthony, great call and great points. Brian, anything to add there?
No, I agree with Anthony. It's right. It's about safety, and it's about those pilots, and it's about training, and that's what we're doing at SkyUp. We're taking that training out to the public.
Yeah, and if you missed it earlier, Brian created a program at MCC, and you get another class starting in March. Is that right?
That is correct.
I'm actually asking, and this is not like a softball to Brian. I don't even know. Is it still open registration now?
It is open registration. It's filling up fast. You can either go to the Workforce Forward, which is part of MCC's website, or if you just simply go to skyop.com, we have a direct link to where you actually register for the course. And it's a great course. We've had marvelous reviews. I just had a telephone call before I came into the studio, and someone said, well, this course actually cost $14.99. Gee, that's a little expensive. It costs more than some flight systems. But in every case, we've run the course 3 times now. I'm just in the middle of my 4th one, also for Mohawk Valley Community College. And every time we give a survey following the classes, we get rave reviews and people consistently saying, I'm so happy I took this because it really gave me all the information I was looking for. It's hard to find a reliable source of the information that we provide in a single place on the internet. And so what we do is we take a real extensive approach to giving you everything you need.
Before I get back to the phones, Ryan Delaney from the Innovation Trail, you heard Anthony talking about the safety is in the hands of the pilots. There have been questions about registration or stricter rules. Do you expect, as a reporter, I mean, I don't know how much movement you've heard, do you expect a tightening, anything else when it comes to restricting who can fly these things and where?
Well, I think if the FAA has any say over it, there will be, and maybe this will be part of the regulations that we've been waiting so long for. To get one of these certificates to fly directly through New Air, there is a training process for these operators. They have to log hours and, you know, be certified in order to be one of the official test sites. But and we're also seeing the, you know, increase in classes like Mr. Petrie's and all the way up to four-year degree programs at schools like the University of North Dakota and a handful of others across the country that are offering pretty extensive programs and using these aircraft. But the problem is on the other side of this, you know, $400 in an Amazon Prime account, and you can have one of these on your doorstep in 2 days, and that doesn't require any sort of training. So I think we need to, the only way you could probably make sure everyone is certified, licensed, insured on these is making it harder to get them, which might not necessarily be the best thing for the growth of the industry. But you know, I can't buy an airplane on the internet quite as easily as I can a small drone.
Right. Tim in Pittsburgh, thanks for calling. Go ahead, Tim.
Hey, Evan. I'm not a huge fan of being tracked through my phone and computer and drones, although I think those days are long gone of me just being kind of left alone. But as far as the police and maybe military use, I think people should think about it first before just blankly opposing it. I mean, would you rather have one of these drones going in and doing the dirty work or going after simply put bad people or terrorists, or would you rather have your loved one going in there going after these people? And I think, you know, you hear about in the Middle East and oh, how terrible these things are, and yeah, you're right, they do hit the wrong people occasionally, but for some reason I guess I just have more trust in someone behind a computer almost. I know there's human error and I trust our military, but if it's between, you know, my brother, my uncle, you know, whoever going in there or sending a, you know, a machine in there, I don't think that's much of a choice really.
Tim, thanks for the call. Brian, what do you think?
Well, I tend to agree with him. I think that there's so many lives that can be saved in the public safety element. I'm right now writing my second curriculum, which is targeted towards public safety individuals, which is police, fire, and emergency management. And they can use all the help these things can provide. When you look at whether it's tracking a criminal in a chase to being on an active fire scene and being able to go up and see where the hot spots are in the fire and to really get the bird's eye view of what's happening, this will save lives and a lot of lives of our public safety individuals. And so I'm really big on making that a big part of my education program, because today what I find is so often public safety, they get the same information you do. They hear it in the news, and sometimes there's these negative perceptions. And so what I'm doing right now is putting together this course to talk about all the things that they don't know, okay? And there's quite a few, and I think it's going to be very well received.
Ryan Delaney, thoughts on what Tim was saying?
Well, while we have brought up the military a little bit, I do have one more name for these aircraft, and the Air Force has told me a couple times that the term that they prefer is remotely piloted aircraft, kind of pointing out the fact that there is still a person controlling these. They just happen to be on the ground instead of up in the air, and it's not an autonomous computer or an android. The law enforcement and emergency services, I think those will be some of the earlier applications from the government side that we see from these. And, you know, law enforcement likes the idea of the same thing, not even necessarily overseas, here in the U.S., being able to send something like this into a hostage situation or a active shooter situation, which you know, could potentially save an officer's life or not put them in as much risk.
I recall in 2004 in Macedon, Wayne County, there was thoughts that there was a large marijuana growing operation in the middle of a huge cornfield as kind of a way to hide it. And so the Macedon police took up a powered parachute. Is that the term, Brian Petrie? It looked like a lawn chair with a parachute on it.
Yeah, I think it's a parasail is what it's called.
And we were about 1,000 feet off the ground. I mean, we could see all the way to the bottom of Canandaigua Lake from the air. But again, so if you're wondering how would a police agency use this kind of thing, well, perhaps that's an idea among others. Jeremy writes to the program, how are they powered? How long and how far can they fly? Brian?
That's one of the big misconceptions. I've had a lot of people come up to me and say, oh, this would be great for border patrol. We'll just put this quadcopter up there and just let it sit there and guard the border. Well, it turns out that these systems are all battery powered today. They're LiPo batteries. The flight times vary depending upon whether it's a quadcopter or there are fixed wings that only have a single motor. But typically you'll find maybe 20 to 40 minutes on a quadcopter and a little bit longer on fixed wing systems that can go upwards to an hour, hour and a half. So they're pretty short in duration.
Back to the phones. This is Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, what bothers me about this is it is just one more surveillance tool. We can't possibly know whose hands it may end up in, Big Brother's or who. But, you know, we put these video cameras up everywhere all over the place, and there was a time when we just went into hysterical fits over the idea of having cameras watching us, and that has just been worn away so that we seem to just accept more and more piling on of technological surveillance, more power, again, in whose hands. And the promised benefits don't work out. We still have all the white-collar crime that has done so much damage to our country, and street crime. People are afraid to go out. And I think we all feel watched. Even President Bush, he said, oh, no, I don't use email. You know, I like my privacy. And so if a president can't have privacy, what about all the rest of us? So I think we're just piling on. And, yeah, there's probably a theoretical good benefit for a lot of things that end up having unintended consequences. Thank you.
Thanks, Jane. Brian, go ahead.
Well, there's always those unintended consequences, but I can assure you that the benefits that we receive from these far outweigh some possible problems with them. It's already been stated that, for example, agriculture, which many people believe is the single largest application for these particular systems, if we don't allow this to occur in the United States, what's happening is the technology is going off offshore, and what we're going to see in large farming situations, for example, is they're going to have higher crop yields. They're going to be able to farm better than we are unless we catch up with this particular technology. And by the way, when you think about that, that's just not a few dollars. It's billions of dollars that we're talking about. And it can change the way farmers in this country farm. But we need to have that allowed.
Ryan Delaney from the Innovation Trail, some final thoughts on drones looking ahead this year and beyond here. Leave us with some things to look for as this conversation continues.
I think the biggest thing I'm waiting to see right now is, first, when the FAA is going to start allowing these. They've dragged their feet for years, and there was a lot of pushback on that, and finally these test sites are starting to get up and running, but I think there's still a lot of frustration within the industry, and you're seeing the FAA kind of relax its own rules a little bit. First some waivers for filming in California. Last week, I think it was, the FAA agreed to partner with CNN here in the U.S. to come up with rules. So I'm waiting to see some of the regulations on these start to trickle out.
Ryan Delaney, thanks for taking the time to join us. And we can find more of your work where?
InnovationTrail.org.
Keep up the good work. Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate the insight and the background there. We've got a few more minutes here with Brian Petrie. And for those, if you're just joining us, Brian's company is called SkyUp, which was born when? When did you create SkyUp, Brian?
SkyUp, we originally filed in January of 2013. And at that particular moment in time, we went out to see how we could apply these into various disciplines. And as it turned out, I find the overwhelming need is that of education. So that's what we've become as an education company.
And when it comes to the length of time these things can fly, as following, pigging back on Jeremy's question there, are people surprised when they come into your class to hear that they're 40 minutes, maybe an hour, maybe a little more than that?
More often than not, I would say that they are. Especially, I've been doing trade shows and been out facing the public, and that's where we see the most surprise. If you have some understanding of battery power, you're not as surprised. And part of the reason is because it's not a linear improvement. If you make the battery bigger, it's also heavier, and that reduces, you get diminishing returns. And so you have to find that right balance of what these batteries can do.
What do you expect to change in 1, 3, and 5 years in this? We've talked about what could change. What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that if we look back, even just a little bit further, 10 years from now, we're going to look back upon this and we're going to say, this was truly transformative. And it changed many of the things in our lives, and I contend they'll be positive. And I think that's the biggest shock that's out there. If we go in a shorter distance, say 2 years from now, because it's going to take at least that long before we're going to see any regulations put into place by the FAA, just the fact that we have them, I think, will be something to look forward to. If we look out 4 or 5 years, then we are going to see things like delivery capabilities by Amazon. I think that's sort of the time frame that they expect, and I think it's possibly reasonable. So we're going to see a constant change with all of this.
And last quick point here, do you at least acknowledge that while you view this with positives, the concern out there with some is real, and where there is abuse, there must be strict vigilance?
Absolutely true. Yes, I believe in vigilance. And I also believe that training people that they have a moral responsibility and obligation when you use these tools is something that we also put in our curriculum.
That's part of your class.
It is definitely part of my class.
With power comes great responsibility.
Exactly.
No joke. Brian Petrie, one more time, real briefly, your website for SkyOp
is www.skyop.com.
You can learn more about the class that he is teaching at MCC that has been popular, and you see the interest here. Thank you for taking the time to come in and share your thoughts about what certainly is a changing and growing industry.
Thank you, Evan.
And thanks to all the great and interesting questions from our listening audience these 2 hours today. Val LeBanca behind the glass. Great work today engineering the program. I'm Evan Dawson. By the way, for all those who have asked recently, I should mention this more often. The music you're hearing is by a band called Ra Ra Riot. It's called Shadow Casting. Our thanks to Barsook Records. And thanks for listening to Connections on member-supported public radio.
This program is a production of WXXI Public Radio. The views expressed do not necessarily